Have you been avoiding conflict lately? Are you afraid that if you speak your truth to someone, you might damage the relationship permanently? Is inner conflict eating you up inside? Maybe you're thinking one thing, but doing another, and you just can't seem to get your head and heart to line up. As humans, we all deal with conflict. Join Jennifer McKenna now as she talks to business leaders about the importance of conflict and how we can all move through it with greater grace and ease, ultimately taking our relationships and our lives to the next level by facing conflict courageously.
Welcome to the show today, everyone. We are going to be talking about anti-Semitism in today's world. As you know, each week we cover a different cultural topic because what we're really trying to tackle is conflict in general. We have a lot of divisive cultural issues that all of us are trying to digest every day and trying to find ways to live more peacefully and joyfully in the midst of being inundated all day, every day through multiple sources of all of the divisiveness and conflict out there. So this show is intended to help you work through that and feel like you have more knowledge about each of these divisive topics and that you can do something for yourself and others to bring you to a better state of peace. So oftentimes I'm talking to business leaders, and today I'm talking to a very important community leader. So welcome, Rabbi Lawrence, to the show.
Thank you, Jennifer.
So glad to have you.
I'm glad.
And what would you like for me to call you during the
Lawrence
show?
Lawrence is fine. If it's good enough for my parents, it's good enough for everybody.
Perfect. I love it. So can you tell us, talk to me about, well, first of all, you're located here in Atlanta. And,
yeah, I'm in an area called Buckhead, Atlanta, Georgia, at a synagogue called Ahavath Achim Synagogue. But the name is so complicated. It means brotherly love, but it's so complicated to say that everybody calls this place the AA Synagogue, not to be confused with the other and very important AA, although we're technically older than the other AA. AA is much more famous. So we run with that kind of thing. So everybody calls us the AA Synagogue.
Well, I will say that in my children's minds, you are famous because your synagogue hosted Vice President Joe Biden, and we were blessed to be guests during his visit there, and thoroughly enjoyed his speech.
Well, we're very lucky. We have a congregant named Stuart Eisenstadt, who was an ambassador and is a lawyer in D.C., and he's done a lot of work with government in the government. He lives in D.C., but he still is very connected to the synagogue, so he brings what was called the Eisenstadt Lecture, the Fran and Stuart and family Eisenstadt Lecture, to the synagogue, and there's always these incredible named people. We're going to be having another one, I believe, in the fall, around December time. I can't announce who it's going to be, but it'll be great. Yeah, they always are.
Okay.
And I remember that Biden one. That was really special.
It was. It was really remarkable. I hope to be lucky enough to attend future events. So in the meantime, share with us, if you don't mind, why you decided to become a rabbi. Why are you passionate about what you're doing? What do you do? How did you get there? Tell us a little bit about your background.
I appreciate the opportunity. So it was kind of a convergence of a lot of different things at once. I grew up in a rather secular home. My home was Jewish. When I was very young, we did have some rituals. But then I was born and raised in Los Angeles, California, and my parents got divorced when I was about 9 or 10, and all that kind of stopped. And so what used to be Shabbat dinner on Friday night turned into Friday night sushi at a local sushi restaurant, kind of the L.A. thing to do. And so I kind of grew up in my teenage years and early 20s rather secular. I was studying science in school, and so I was really kind of running with that crowd. But at some point, I really decided a few things. Number one is I found that I thought differently than other people. Just the way that I looked at the world was a bit different than my friends, my classmates, the people in the research lab that I was working in. So I started to do some self-discovery and thought to myself, well, maybe being Jewish has something to do with that, because all of my friends weren't Jewish. And so I just started to explore that, and I fell in love with the learning and the study, and I found that Jewish observance really made my life meaningful. It added meaningful expression into the things that I did. But that didn't necessarily lead me to be a rabbi. It just led me to be more of an observant Jew. And what ended up happening is that as I was studying psychology in school, I was really looking to be part of people's, the human condition. I was looking to understand it and be part of people's, kind of human life existence. And I wasn't finding exactly what I was looking for in psychology. And I eventually, I was still studying Judaism, just Judaism lightly, at the local synagogue or other places, and learning and reading. But I was really focusing on science as my career. And my grandmother passed away during this time. This was about 1999, when she passed away. And I went with my father and my aunt to the rabbi's office, where they were going to meet and talk about my grandmother and prepare for her funeral, which was just going to be the next day or a day away from that. And I watched my father and my aunt, who were rather tough people. They just kind of melted in front of this rabbi and let this person who, they knew him, but they didn't know him really well. And like I said, I didn't grow up going to the synagogue every week. We barely went. So I really didn't know this person very well at all. And I just watched my dad and my aunt invite this man into their life, into a very sacred and holy part of their life. And it was at that moment I said to myself, well, that's it. That's what I was looking for. I wasn't necessarily looking to understand the human condition. I was looking to be part of it. And so I started to explore what it would look like to be a rabbi. I love the study. I love the learning. I love the ritual. And now I have this opportunity to really be part of people's spiritual journeys, people's life journeys, in a really meaningful way. And so that's really been what's driven me as a rabbi. And although everything that I mentioned is true, I didn't know the complexities of being in a community. It's challenging. It's kind of all over the place. You're dealing with lots of different situations. Some of them feel very holy in the moment. Others, the holiness only comes much later, and they could just be very aggravating and difficult. And of course, sometimes you have to deal with things that just aren't holy at all, and they're just kind of the mundane, difficult tasks of life. But it's been extremely meaningful. And what I'm passionate about in my work are the spiritual journeys of the people that I come in contact with. I just get – it's just such an amazing experience to be part of somebody's life in a moment of grief, in a moment of celebration, in a time when people are kind of lost and confused, or when people are really seeking kind of a greater impact in the world, that they come to me and I'm able to help them on that journey. And that's really been very special. And so that's where I've been very fortunate in trying to lead my congregation towards. And I've had great people working with me to get us there. And we're coming into that place where we are really focusing on people's journeys and helping them live a very full and meaningful life in our way through a very Jewish practice, lens, behavior. So it's been very special.
Wonderful. Well, I actually relate to it. Now, people don't think of me with such reverence, I'm certain. But as a coach, I feel the same way. I am invited in at a very sacred level to someone's life. I've worked with, hundreds of people over the years, and every time it's so humbling to be to play such an intimate role in someone's life and help them really become the best version of themselves as they contribute to the world in their way. And so I do relate to that. And I think it's very powerful that you have a position like that where you can lead an entire community towards some of the same, common goals in that evolutionary process for people.
Well, thank you. And I appreciate that. I think that what you do is probably very akin to what I do, in that when you're meeting with someone and you're talking with them, you're not just listening to whatever it is they're telling you, but you're also hearing deeper, on a deeper level, of their hopes and their fears and their concerns and their dreams and aspirations. And you being on the outside and helping and being part of that experience, you get to point them in that right direction and watch them grow in it. There's something very special, and like I've been saying so far in the conversation, something very holy about it.
Yes, Absolutely. And I think that's why I'm passionate about doing a show about conflict and all the things that divide us, because in those moments of, you know, sacred intimacy where you're helping that person through their darkest fears, through their most agonizing challenges, you realize the power of that transformation. When you can help each individual move through those moments and see what they become and what their lives become on the other side of that, it's so extraordinary and humbling and powerful. And I, you know, so I've just become passionate about how do we do this on a mass level? And a lot of that is why I chose many years ago to go into the actual workplace, because I can work with more people at one time. So I suppose you could look at the corporate sector as my synagogue. And if we were to use the analogy further. But I'll say this too, another interesting thing about my background, I think relevant to this conversation specifically, which is why I was so eager to talk to you, because on a personal level, the Jewish community has meant so much to me over the years. And so I want to go back a little bit of time and give a little bit of a background for listeners about me that they would not know. About 25 years ago, I moved to Atlanta from Indiana. I was a small town girl raised in southern Indiana. And I went to school in northern Indiana at Purdue University. I was working in central Indiana in Indianapolis. And I decided I had seen enough of Indiana and I wanted to head south and have a more quote unquote cultural experience. And what I mean by that is at the age of 25, I was very eager for more diversity in my life. I truly felt, and this may or may not be actually true, but my existence felt bland. I had a beautiful relationship with my friends and family. I was surrounded by wonderful, lovely, just wonderful people. But I knew nothing about anybody who wasn't just, you know, a white Christian heterosexual person. As silly as that may sound, I really felt a lack of culture, so to speak. And so my soul honestly craved a more diverse experience. And so first thing that happens to me, I hadn't even moved to Atlanta. I was visiting to check out the city. And I met someone out that I ended up dating for 3 years. And he just happened to be Jewish. But the most interesting part about him was he was the first Jewish person I had ever met. I had made it 25 years on the planet before I met a Jewish person. So that speaks volumes about why my soul might have been craving some diversity. But so I was so ignorant to the Jewish culture. I mean, so deeply ignorant that I thought Yom Kippur was the Chinese New Year. And as we started dating, he was reading an article that just really hurt his heart so much. And he was reading it to me, and it was on anti-Semitism, and he just kept reading it. And I finally walked over to the newspaper. I said, "Show me this word. I don't know this word. You keep saying it." And the word was anti-Semitism. I had never heard it in my life. I had no idea what it meant. When he told me what it meant, my jaw dropped to the floor. Now, he got a belly laugh out of this because he could not believe he was dating such a naive person. But the fact of the matter was, I had lived such a sheltered life, I just was plain ignorant. So yeah, go ahead.
I think that's something that you're bringing up, which was one of the driving factors that, you know, I was talking about with my own journey coming back into Judaism, in addition to my grandmother, and in addition to just, you know, the way I thought and trying to explore that. One of the things that really came to the fore for me that was driving my exploration was that I grew up around a lot of diversity. So I kind of had the opposite experience. I grew up in Los Angeles. I went to a public school. Some of my best friends were Hindi. They were Muslim. They were, you know, I had just all over the map, just people. And what at some point I realized when I would go to their homes, it was such an interesting cultural experience going to their homes and the food that they ate and the way that the parents dressed and talked in different languages. Now, they might have looked just like me, maybe a difference in skin color, but we wore the same clothes, we did the same things, we skateboarded, we surfed, we did whatever, right? But and played music, but when I went to their homes, it was such a different cultural experience. And what I realized at some point was the only thing that I offered them in my home, because we spent a lot of time in my house, was I had cable television. That was the only thing I was offering to them, kind of this cultural milieu that I, you know, this cultural, this really cultural setting, was that I had cable television and that my mom was gone, you know, a lot. She was very, she was a physician and a very sought after researcher and speaker. So she traveled a lot. And so we always had parties at my house. Like that was all that I got to contribute. So my life was made richer by everybody else, but yet I was not contributing anything to it. So part of my own investigation and my own life journey was that I want to give something back to this amazing world that we live in. I want people to meet me and interact with me and get a cultural experience, which they weren't getting. I was just kind of American, you know, just plain old cable television, bologna in the refrigerator kind of existence, right? Nothing really special.
Well, you may have been giving them a cultural experience depending on what you were sharing with them through that media, the cable channel.
at it was at the time. So mainly it.
Well, so I spin on that though, right? That cable and media and all these things, they do influence us, how we think, how we view the world. And right now we have a lot of divisiveness over that, right? We've got a whole administration that's trying to convince us that the media is nothing but fake news. I mean, that's become kind of a joke at our house. If I tell my son he's done something wrong, he'll yell fake news. But so it's really convenient here. But the bottom line is it's disturbing that we're not we're choosing to be ignorant, right, as a culture. And I can't say all of us are. I'm just saying that we're starting to perpetuate something that I think is very dangerous. And so on this show today, I really want you to set kind of the record straight so that if anyone out there is listening, right, who may be a little bit more knowledgeable than I was 25 years ago, but not as knowledgeable as maybe they could be or even should be in order to even weigh in with an opinion or to ask themselves, is there a part of me that has a bias, positive or negative, toward the Jewish people? Mm-hmm. You know, and so for those of you, if anyone's out there who is as ignorant as I was, anti-Semitism is a word that describes the prejudice against Jewish people. And hopefully I'm not simplifying that too much, but and if I am, please correct me because there's probably a much better way to say it. But that's what we want to talk about today. And New York Times just had an article out 2 days ago about anti-Semitism in Germany and the residual impact of Nazi Germany and what, you know, may have led to it, but what we're still dealing with all these years later. So I'm only talking about 25 years ago when I was that ignorant, but wow, they're dealing with residual impact from many years ago, and your whole community may feel as though this has been going on since the beginning of time. So can you share with us, you know, what is the history? We're going to take a quick commercial break. When we come back, if you can share the true history of anti-Semitism and your views on that, we'd love to hear them. Stay tuned.
Connecting you with the best of the conscious minds in the world. Om Times Radio. IOM FM.
Om Times Magazine is one of the leading online content providers of positivity, wellness, and personal empowerment. A philanthropic organization, their net proceeds are funneled to support worldwide charity initiatives via Humanity Healing International. Through their commitment to creating community and providing conscious content, they aspire to uplift humanity on a global scale. Connect at omtimes.com. Om Times, creating a more conscious lifestyle.
I'm Kathy Williams, host of Sexy Mom Abundant Life radio show on Thursdays at 5 p.m. Eastern, 2 p.m. Pacific. On the show, we explore living abundantly in every area of your life. Ways to let go of limiting patterns and beliefs and to step into the flow of creativity and possibility, knowing you are supported by the universe.
Opiates has taken everything and everyone I've ever loved away from me. Everything.
I blew my ankle out and I got prescribed pain pills by my doctor.
If making my detox public is going to help somebody, I'm all for it. I just wish I would have had a warning.
Opioid dependence can happen after just 5 days. Know the truth, spread the truth. A message from Truth, the Ad Council, and ONDCP.
Welcome back, everyone. We're speaking to Rabbi Lawrence today and wanting to know your views on this, anti-Semitism. What do you have to say? What are the jaded views, the history? I don't even know where to begin on what to ask you, so I'm going to let you take the lead.
Well, I appreciate that, Jennifer. Thank you. The question before the commercial break that you asked is like, what is the history of anti-Semitism? The challenge I think we're going to have on any podcast or really any kind of any media outlet in today is that we struggle with doing deep dives on any issue. And the history and understanding anti-Semitism is really going to take a real deep dive. I think any of the anti-movements that you have require a deep dive to really understand them. If any of your listeners want, there's a really wonderful YouTube by Rabbi Jonathan Sacks, who was used to be the chief rabbi of Great Britain. And he does a really wonderful analysis, very quick, 2 minutes, which is about the attention span, unfortunately, of our society. So it kind of works. But he does a quick overview of the history of anti-Semitism. And, of course, it's simplistic. And I probably am going to mess up the terminologies that he uses. He did, of course, much more elegant than I would. But he talks about kind of 4 stages of anti-Semitism. The early stages of history that get talked about in the Bible or in the biblical history, so like the Babylonians when they exiled the Hebrews and the Jews from Jerusalem, when you talk about the Syrian Greeks or the Romans, you know, centuries later and around the time of the turn of the millennia, you know, where in the, you know, the time of the life of Jesus of Nazareth, those calendar years, he makes the argument that those really aren't anti-Semitic incidences. When you talk about the Romans or you talk about the Babylonians, those early stories, those are really just like xenophobic. Those are really just examples of different civilizations clashing with one another and not liking the other. And Jews were just not as powerful as maybe the Babylonians were or the Romans were, and so they were exiled or they were destroyed or all the terrible things that get talked about in the Bible, and then, of course, historians come in later. We do get some hints in the Bible of what seem to be the beginning of anti-Semitism, kind of the and in these stories. And I don't look at the Bible myself as a historical document. I look at it as a spiritual document. So I kind of think it's kind of warning us, giving us a forewarning of what was to come many years in the future, and for something for us to really be cognizant of. One of the first examples that you have, of course, is Pharaoh in the early book of Exodus. When you look at that story, it talks about Pharaoh really became paranoid. He became paranoid that these very different people, again, it plays out somewhat xenophobic, but he gets paranoid that these people are going to rise up and leave. And so he oppresses the Jewish people, and he goes into a campaign of genocide against the firstborn males, and then of course the story of the Exodus unfolds, and the Jews get out. You also have another story later on in the Bible of the book of Esther, where it talks about Haman, the viceroy of King Ahasuerus, who Queen Esther, who is the Jewess, saves the day. But this kind of homicidal man is in power. And, of course, we've seen that play out throughout history. A new king arose over Egypt, and that was Pharaoh. And he was a paranoid, paranoid murderer. And we've seen that over play out in history. And then, with the story of Haman, you've seen that, kind of a homicidal madman as well. You've seen that play out over history. But the early examples, as I said, the Babylonians, the Romans, Rabbi Sacks would make the claim that that isn't necessarily anti-Semitism. It's more of a xenophobia or just kind of, you know, colonial conquering. What he first starts to see the beginning of anti-Semitism with Constantine and the kind of the beginning of the Christian world, where there was a theological argument made that there was a people that needed to be subjugated, and that was the Jewish people, and it was on theological grounds that they denied the tenets of that new religion, and so therefore they were somewhat lesser because of it. That, Rabbi Sacks would say, then morphed into, centuries later, into a demonic anti-Semitism. The idea that the Jews are demons and the Jews are doing terrible things, they're killing Christian babies and drinking their blood, they're using them for their rituals, they're making matzah, the thin cracker that we use on Passover, and they're equating kind of the Jew as this demonic presence in the world, kind of like the devil incarnate making its way through. And that was very much in the Middle Ages. You get up to more of the Enlightenment era, and there's another transition that Rabbi Sacks talks about, where you get the kind of the racial profiling of the Jewish people, and saying that, in fact, they are a different race, and they need to be kept in line or subjugated or destroyed because they are different from us. They're kind of a new, they're a different form, not a new form, but a different form of human. And then finally, in the more recent years, you've gotten into this kind of a national anti-Semitism, where you've looked at the Jewish people as they are a people and a part of a nation, and, you know, in particular, the State of Israel, and therefore there are reasons to hate them. What Rabbi Sacks, I haven't listened to that YouTube clip in a long time, is that I don't think he makes the claim that I would, that I think that these have built up on each other. And it isn't that, like, you know, 2,000 years ago you had theological, and then 1,200 years ago you had demonic, or 1,000 years ago you had demonic, and 300 years ago you had racial. I think that one has grown into the other, and they've all become part of each other. So today you have this anti-Semitism that is just illogical. It just doesn't, if you get down to the root of it and start to really explore it, it doesn't make, in my opinion, it's ridiculous. Now, I guess you could say I'm biased because I'm a Jew, and so I don't like other people hating me. But it is
ridiculous.
It's ridiculous and made up of a lot of...
It is ridiculous.
aren't true, and those haven't been rooted out. But to understand it, you have to take a deep dive. You have to take a deep dive into the subject, and that's really difficult for us today. So anti-Semitism today becomes more complicated because people, they might see it, they might experience it, they might read it in the news, but they don't have the patience or the time to to do the deep dive, and history doesn't really matter anymore. So it's really easy for people to say, well, if there's anti-Semitism, they must have done something to deserve it, right? I can't imagine that, you know, that it comes out of nowhere, or that it's a plague on kind of the inner spiritual world that we live in. People can't really hear that. So what they say is that, well, maybe the Jews did something to deserve it. Maybe there's a reason for it, which of course is a terrible and ridiculous claim. But it's kind of what happens. And part of that is because we don't want to learn our history. We don't have the time or the chance.
But it sounds, you know, there's the old adage, history repeats itself, right? And so much of that is just that life is cyclical, nature is cyclical. The human brain, right, thrives on habit. So we like cycles. We like to just stay in predictable possibilities. You know, it's just we don't want to look at the unknown in terms of possibilities because the brain really resists that. So, you know, I just think that we're living in a time where there's that same frame of mind too that seems to be cyclical, that's coming back around to use the ugliness within ourselves, whether it's fear-based or just, you know, well, I mean, I like to think that all hatred is based in ignorance, and ignorance is, you know, and it all can come from a space of fear. Because I was ignorant 25 years ago, but I certainly didn't have any negative misconceptions or perceptions. So I was raised in an environment where we came from a space of love. And then you try to just kind of figure out what you needed to know along the way, but we never defaulted to prejudice of anyone different than us. And so
Jennifer, I think you're saying, I'm sorry to interrupt. You're saying two things that I think are really important here that I don't want us to skip over. So the first thing is that, you know, I think that the reason why you could believe that things like anti-Semitism or hate or racism or anything like that come from a place of ignorance is because of the way that you were raised, like you said, was from a place of love. That those two things are interconnected. If people don't have a foundation for how to control the kind of animal instinct, which we all have, we're all animals, and you know, religion at its best, in my opinion, is to help overlay on top of the animal instinct a holy spiritual education to help curtail the animal instinct. And you, whether it was through religious doctrine or just in the foundation that your parents gave you, which is of course very possible. You don't have to use religion in order to get that. You got the platform of I have to come from a place of love. So therefore, you could work through any of the animal instincts to hate the other or to be fearful or to be scared of the other. Because you had that foundation of I have to come from a place of love. That would be the equivalent of, let's say, having the biblical doctrine of I cannot oppress a stranger, right? I have to be kind to the stranger, or I have to, you know, love my neighbor as myself. You know, those type of doctrines, your family instilled in you that place of love. Many families don't give over that foundation to their children. And so what ends up happening is that we have kind of a whole society, and there are whole societies throughout the world that don't have that foundation. And what they are left with is they have their animal self. And the animal self could best be seen if you have a dog. Jennifer, do you have a dog or a cat or anything like that?
All of the above.
All of the above. Okay. So next, I want you to sometime watch your cat stare out the window and watch what happens when your cat sees a squirrel run across the yard. Right? Mm-hmm. Or let's say your dog, and you're walking your dog, and your dog sees another dog, right? A different type of dog, right? There's some instinct in those animals, which I wouldn't say is evil. Like, I mean, that's part of that. Part of being a dog, part of being a cat. It's part of being a squirrel. Whatever it is, there's an animal instinct of when you see something other than you, you are filled with fear, anxiety. You might have anger, hate. You might have aggressive nature. Well, that happens in human beings as well. Now, the religion, in the best of that religion has to offer, is to curtail that and overlay a mindfulness to say, I am not going to act on that. I am going to take my fear and use it productively. I'm going to take my cautiousness that I have when I encounter others, and I'm going to come at it with curiosity rather than anxiety. And you came to those situations saying, I'm going to come from it with a place of love. And you kind of had that drilled into you. So that let you say, my fear, my anger, my whatever about Jews or about African Americans or about Native Americans or about Hispanics or whatever, I'm going to come at them with a place of love. That opened you up to then getting rid of your ignorance. If you don't have that foundation, it becomes very difficult, very, very difficult to curtail that animal instinct of saying the other is bad. I need to protect myself and my things, my nuts and berries from the other, and so I will be aggressive. That makes sense?
Well, I think, yes, and I think you make excellent points, and it does call to mind the consciousness in it, because I have to admit that it was so ingrained in me, I didn't have a consciousness about it. I didn't choose that loving perspective or that naive perspective. It was already built inside of me. It was my default mechanism. But as a coach and going into many workplaces where there is a lot of conflict everywhere I turn when I get there, right? By the time I leave, not the case, but I'm accustomed to it. And I have now, as an adult, seen what you're talking about, which is for many people, there has to be a conscious intent to come from that space, right? that my job as a coach is to help create that paradigm within their mental framework, to help them choose a loving perspective and make decisions from that space instead of, as you're calling it, the instinct. And I was fortunate enough that the way I was raised, it was my instinct. But that is not the case for many people.
Well, that becomes more and more difficult, you know, as people have lost trust in spiritual communities, whether you want to call them religious communities or religious doctrine. People have lost trust, and don't get me wrong. I think that there's been a lot of abuse in religious communities, and they've earned the loss of their trust. But as we've gotten rid of those, we're struggling to find replacements for them, and so it really is falling onto the personal example that parents might show to their children, not having any ability to send them to a Sunday school or send them to meditation places or whatever, and so. It's putting a heavy burden on parents to be incredible exemplars, which, as any of us parents know, it's hard to be on all the time. Sometimes you just can't be a great example for your children. Your children will learn lessons, will learn bad habits from you. And if that's all we're left with and don't have these religious communities working at their best, then our children are left without the foundation to then counteract that kind of instinctual protective prejudice that is part of being an animal.
Yes. So given all of this, right, and given the paradigm of today's world that we're seeing reflections of, some of the history you've been speaking about coming to the surface more with, in forms of anti-Semitism, do you think it is on the rise today, or do you think that we just are exposed to more of it? What is your personal opinion on that?
So it's a good question. Anti-Semitism statistically is on the rise. You could go to many websites. The ADL is a good one to look at. Just in 2018, 2019, I looked this up. There were in the United States there were 3,512 incidences. They even have a map if you want to look at where all the incidences are clustered. 3,512 is a lot. One of the questions that you were asking that you asked prior to the show. To me was, do you think it's making headlines? And my immediate reaction to that, the note I wrote down was, no, if there are 3,512 and like all we're really hearing about is a shooting in Squirrel Hill and a shooting in San Diego, well, that's two out of 3,512 incidences. Now, of course, those are the most egregious. And unfortunately, what bothers me, and this is a criticism of kind of our media, is that the old adage for the media, if it bleeds, it leads. That's really it. It's just sensationalism. Mm-hmm. Truth is, many news outlets are not really doing their job in exposing our society for the challenges our society really has. They're just showing the most graphic and most disturbing images they can in order to get us to watch, and then that watching turns into us purchasing all types of advertisements. And so that's a real problem. So I think anti-Semitism is on the lead. I think most of us are really unaware of it, unaware of how much there actually is. And so we get together for these vigils, once a year when people get killed, but we're really not doing anything to combat it in a serious way. When I say we, the society in general, there are lots of great organizations that are working to combat it, but they need all of us. They need all of us to do this and to work on
this. So
and by the
like
way, this is – yeah, go ahead.
Oh, I was just going to say it sounds like it's not fake news. It's just that we're not really telling the right angle of the story in order to change it. But let's talk more about that when we come back.
Free your mind with Om Times Radio, IOM FM. Host your show on IOM FM, the radio network of Om Times Media, one of the more recognized brand names in the conscious community, and is backed by the extensive marketing reach of Om Times. Hosting a show on IOM FM immediately connects you with our extensive dedicated community.
Hello, I'm Sandy Sedgbeer, host of Om Times Magazine's flagship radio show, What is Going On? My passion is sifting through information, research, and innovations from New Thought teachers, speakers, and researchers pushing back the boundaries of what we know about life, energy, metaphysics, and the universe. I love shifting perceptions about who we are, why we're here, and how quickly impossible becomes normal when we open our minds, expand our awareness, and accept that the only limits that exist are those we place upon ourselves. So if you're the kind of forward-thinking, eager investigator of what lies beyond the current reality that most perceive, why not make a date to come play with me in the field of possibilities at 4 p.m. Pacific Time, 7 p.m. Eastern Time every Thursday, and together we can discover what's really going on.
Imagine being fired because of who you love. Imagine being denied medical treatment because of who you marry. Imagine being evicted because of who you are. Millions of Americans don't have to imagine this. They have to live it. Because in 31 states, it's legal to discriminate against LGBT people. Get the facts at beyondido.org. Brought to you by the Gill Foundation and the Ad Council.
Welcome back. We're with Rabbi Lawrence talking about anti-Semitism. So we went to a commercial break. I have a question for you. Before we start diving into what we should be doing to help change this, I asked you a historical question early in the show, and I'd like to ask you another question around what's influencing this from a more recent historical perspective. So we could go back, you know, to in time, hundreds and thousands of years to get to the real point of origin as we did earlier, but what do you think is impacting the rise of anti-Semitism today? What's causing us to stir this pot back up?
It's a really challenging question because there's lots of different regions. What's causing it to rise up in Germany is different from what's causing it to rise up in England versus what's causing it to rise up in Israel and in the Middle East, and what's causing it to rise up here in the United States versus South America. So it's hard to pinpoint a single thing. I think that in the United States, I think we're seeing we're seeing kind of some of the old tropes being used. There's an increase in white nationalism in this country. I think that with kind of recent political gains, I think that white nationalists are emboldened, and that's of course been stoked. Those fires have been stoked, and so their rise in power and influence and publicity, white nationalists don't have anything new to talk about. There's nothing new about what they think and do, and so they only really are able to fall back on the kind of the old conversations. And of course, one of the old conversations that they've had is, you know, the Jews won't replace us, and the evil Jewish lobby and the evil Jewish power institution and things like that. So they have to use those conversations because they really don't have anything new to bring up. So that is being publicized more. So we're hearing more about that. And they're getting platforms and influential positions to be able to kind of spout that rhetoric. So I think that's part of it. With that, what you're seeing is that you're seeing a new – because we're so cloistered and siloed in our media and in our consumption of news, I think we're having new people who are filled with fear being directed and manipulated by – these hate groups, these people who hate, and their fear and their anxiety is so high that it's easy to get them to do really horrible, horrible things. So they'll desecrate cemeteries, Jewish cemeteries, they'll spray paint swastikas on walls because that's their outlet. That's the only outlets they have, and they're young. Many of them could be young and dumb, teenagers and stuff like that. And then, of course, you get the ones who are who have the means to do horrific things like shoot up synagogues, or mosques or bars or whatever they do to kind of spread their hate because they are not only feeling emboldened, but they're also having their fear and hate, their fear and their anxiety manipulated by those who are able to do that.
So this is a
That's what's bringing some of it up here in the United States. Other countries, you know, are dealing with their own residual, like you talked about in Germany, kind of the residual, the leftovers of the horrific anti-Semitism that they just had rampant throughout their history, and that of course came to a terrible apex with the Shoah, what we in the Jewish community call the Holocaust. And unfortunately, the Germany's done a really amazing job at trying to tamp down on it. But as a spiritual leader, one of the things I'll say is that I think that there's something deep inside that is kind of an evil inclination within us that brings a lot of this up. I mean, I do think that there's a spiritual component, a spiritual. Mm-hmm. I wish I could get the term correctly. The kind of a spiritual
If you're not
neurosis.
Fostering it, yeah. If you are not consciously developing your spirit toward love, right?
Yeah.
Then you can just get on these power trips that take over, because if the ego. That, you know, the ego, in my opinion, it's so much of what the ego does in its function is just protects the comfort zone, right? But if your neurological comfort zone is built around fear, then all of that can go haywire around a power trip if you're tapping into a fear, or if you were conditioned to fear a whole community of people. And
you know, what's really interesting is one of the statistics I heard not too long ago was that places that you are having a sharp rise in anti-Semitism are places in the world that there are no Jews. So that's, of course, a very interesting statistic. If there are no Jews there, mm-hmm. then why are they even talking about Jews? But
right.
there's a sharp increase and sharp rise. And again, it comes from the kind of the old language, the old tropes. People don't have anything new to talk about. It's really easy. Mm-hmm. Use those old stories in order to gain power. My father always used to, a quote he used to ascribe to Nietzsche, but I don't think it was Nietzsche. I'm not sure. But the idea that hate plus fear equals power, and a lot of people, and that is just it's an equation that is just easy and simple, and many people use it. So you give somebody, you take somebody that people hate, you tell them that they should fear them, and the person who's directing has all the power. And you see that played out in the media today.
But in like the workplace, when I go in, I'm constantly talking about power in a positive perspective to say, you know what? What we have learned power to be is actually the abuse of power. We have our own power source within. It does come, in my opinion, from a paradigm of either fear or love based.
Yeah.
And so there can be power on either side of that equation, and it has to be a conscious choice. And so,
Interesting things I think that you deal with the issue of anti-Semitism, for me, is actually found in its name. It's interesting, you know, you have homophobia, you have Islamophobia. Why don't you have Judeophobia, right? Why don't we have Hebraophobia, whatever you call it, Jewophobia? We don't. We have anti-Semitism, and that's a real difficult spot to be in, because you could kind of mentally work through it. The phobias, you'd say, well, once I learn not to be fearful of them and learn that there's nothing to fear, then mm-hmm. I'll stop hating them. Since there isn't necessarily a fear of the Jews, but there's this anti-posture of the Jews, it's really difficult to work your way out of it. Really
right, because
to,
then it's taking it
from
to the next
anti.
Level of wanting to conquer and destroy, right? Like anti.
Yeah,
rid of this.
Yeah, I think it's unfortunate that in the LGBT community, there's this terrible backsliding that's happening right now because of the current, you know, kind of political and social climate. But, you know, for a while there were these great strides that the LGBT community made to combat homophobia. And part of the way that was happening is that it was becoming harder and harder for just everyday Americans to be fearful of gay men and women because they were having, there were more and more in their family. The whole campaign of coming out was not just to show, you know, be loud and proud and let's unite, but it was people were coming out in everybody's family. Like everybody was finding a uncle or a cousin or a neighbor or a coworker that was coming out and saying that they were gay, and it became really difficult to be fearful of people that you love and that you care for.
Mm-hmm.
And so that's, you know, that was really one of the amazing things. And like I said, unfortunately, it's terribly backslid. But that's the cure for a phobia, right? What's the cure for an anti? The anti is that they're in my presence, and I need to have an intellectual posture against them. That's, by the way, when Rabbi Sacks talked about these different constructs and historical postures of anti-Semitism. You see that they're all, in some way or another, intellectual exercises. That's the thing. Mm-hmm. Theological, demonic, racial, national, those are intellectual exercises. I have to think through how a Jew is racially different than me, right? Because otherwise they look just like me, right? So if I had a fear of Jews, then if I was Jewophobic, then it would, you know, it would be impossible because they look just like me, right? They you know, the same. Even for white America today, most Jews in America are, you know, there are Jews of color, which I'm very grateful for, and is really an amazing part of our culture and civilization. But, you know, the majority of Jews you see around the United States are what we consider to be white-skinned. Really hard to be phobic of that. But if you have an intellectual exercise where you say, they, even though they look like me, they are actually different from me, and I will tell you, list the reasons, that becomes really difficult to paint yourself out of that, or to get yourself out of that painted corner.
It's fascinating, and much of what you cited before is around, you know, like that white nationalism and the fear of being overpowered or overshadowed. Right. And they use that toward multiple communities, not just the Jews, but the Jewish community takes a huge hit from that. I do agree with you that that is a huge influencing factor here. And it makes me speculate that with so much ease in accessing information through the internet, if even areas that are not populated with Jews are doing this, it's triggering the same thing. Well, what if they do come and live here? What if they do take us over? What, you know, who knows? I mean, I'm citing kind of crazy ideas, but it at the same time, when you investigate it, it is crazy, in my opinion. It's completely insane that there are people who have such hateful beliefs toward people that they have never met and do not know. And I know that this happens all the time around the world, but I have to own the fact that now 25 years later, I'm still naive. I don't want to believe that people do that, but they do. And I'm just going to say this too. I have a personal story where back in those days when I was 25, my boyfriend at the time, my 3-year boyfriend, we had serious plans. We were talking casually about being married, and his mother was raised in Morocco, and they were exiled to Israel. And when I say exiled, I mean, literally there are whole groups of Jewish people and communities that are driven out, or were back then, you know, and decided, you know, Israel was going to be home. It was going to have to be home. And so my boyfriend was a first generation American, and his family hosted a Seder at Passover. It was my first Seder experience. And I got to know his parents. We dated for 3 years. Lovely people, beautiful family. And she took me aside when no one else was around. And she said, Jennifer, you and her, I wish I could imitate her beautiful, thick accent. Gorgeous woman, very tall, statuesque. And she says, you are a wonderful, sweet young woman, but you will never marry my son. And that was the end of our relationship. because he would not stand up to her, and I gave it a little bit more time, but then I realized this was never going to work. And so that was really hard. I also would say that when I was a small, small child watching the movie of Christ being crucified, I wanted to work for Mother Teresa. I was such a devout Irish Catholic little girl, and watching that horrific movie of his crucifixion. I mean, there have been, my point is this. There have been moments in my life where I easily could have defaulted to a misunderstanding about the Jewish people and harbored bitterness and resentment and anger. But that never happened. So when I hear of people who come at this from that anti, as you say, the anti-Semitic mental framework, I just have no tolerance for it. It's not even a tolerance issue. I have no understanding of it, which was the point of the show today. So I thank you so much for sharing all your views. I think they're hugely insightful and very valuable. And before we close out, what would you say to people that they can do on an individual level that could make a big difference?
A couple things that I thought about. You know, number one, you got to work really hard. I think all of us have to work really hard to not be ruled by fear or hate or anger. I think that we need to always seek to do something kind. It would be really interesting if we all took at the end of the day an inventory of the kind things we did in a day, and think a little bit more about, could we have done those even kinder? Could we have, you know, were they moments of like just.
You can finish. I'm sorry, we're wrapping up the show. Be kind, everyone, and you know, visit a synagogue, sit in on a Seder. It's a beautiful experience. Thanks for listening. I'll see you next week. Thank you, Rabbi.